Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 3rd, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. I'm really excited about this week's episode. It's a topic that's really near and dear to my heart. But before we dive into it, as always, I do want to thank those of you who support the show. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's heavily because I rely on the support of listeners just like you. This week's top supporters include Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, David Compton, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, and a few more, Patrick Flynn and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so, so, so very much. If you're interested in pledging your support, hearing your name called at the top of the show, getting access to ad-free episodes, and so much more, just visit Patreon, that's patreon.com/talknerdy to learn more. I'm recording this in the middle of a hurricane. I know that you guys know that I recently moved to Florida for a one-year internship for my PhD program in clinical psychology. I'm working in the Counseling Center for Older Adults at Nova Southeastern University. And Florida decided to greet me with an almost Category 5 hurricane. I'm very lucky that here in Fort Lauderdale, we did not get the brunt of it. It pummeled the west coast of the state just earlier today. Yesterday, we had some tornadoes in my area and lots of, you know, rain and flooding. And today, it's been very, very windy outside. And I mean, the conditions were unsafe enough as to cancel clinic. But I'm safe. Everyone I know over here is safe. But I'm really thinking about all of those who are living in the direct path of this quite devastating hurricane, Ian. My thoughts are with them. So listen, we recorded the episode that is about to air quite some time ago, actually before I moved, right before I moved, so maybe a little over a month ago now. It's not very fresh in my mind, but it's kind of like fresh in my heart because it's a really important topic. So I had the opportunity to chat with Dr. Heder Varech, and he is a physician actually at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and his focus is actually on cardiac disease, but he works within a sort of life-limiting illness component of that, like with individuals who are quite sick. And because of that, he writes a lot, reads a lot, works a lot within the palliative care movement as well. And so he's written a few books. I actually am just realizing that he wrote a really important book that I read a while back called Modern Death, How Medicine Changed the End of Life. I work in end-of-life care, but on the psychology side. Wow. it's so funny when you read something, but you don't really know the author, and then you have a chance to meet the author and learn from them. He's got a new book, though, and that's what we mostly talk about on this week's episode. It's called The Song of Our Scars, The Untold Story of Pain. So we're going to talk about chronic pain. We're going to talk about how multifaceted it is in the body, in the mind, in the culture, and also what we've gotten right as a society, what we've gotten wrong, what we've gotten right within the medical establishment, what we're still getting wrong, and what some ways to approach and kind of really bring the focus right back to patient-centered care could be. So yeah, it's an important one, and I hope you guys get as much out of it as I did. Without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Heder Varech. Well, Heder, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I am excited to talk about your new book, The Song of Our Scars, The Untold Story of Pain. And of course, at the very, very top of the cover, you have a glowing blurb from Dr. Mukherjee, which is, you know, a big deal considering just how incredible his lots of his work is, but especially The Emperor of All Maladies. I want to tell you up front,
before we talk about you. I want you to know where I'm coming from as the podcaster. Mm. I used to be a neuroscientist. I moved into clinical psychology. I'm finishing my PhD now in clinical psychology, but I specialize in psycho-oncology, end-of-life, life-limiting illnesses. So I think there's going to be a lot of really interesting crossover, and I'm just fascinated to hear about your perspectives, because that's sort of the area, or at least one aspect of your work, but that's an area where I spend a lot of time, is working with patients who are struggling with pain, and especially suffering and very often, sadly, impending death.
No, I'm just excited to, I know there's so much overlap of interest, so I'm just excited to jump in and learn as much from you and as much as share what I've learned on along the way.
So you are a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. So that's connected to Harvard, right?
Yes. So Harvard is kind of a loose federation, but has three main teaching hospitals. The Brigham is one of them. And I also work at the VA hospital in Boston, which also gives me a totally additional perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as a physician, I mean, what is your specific specialty? Number one, what did you specialize in residency and fellowship? But what do you kind of consider yourself practicing now?
Sure. My residency was in internal medicine, which is about, as broad of training as you can get. And then my subspecialty training was actually in cardiology.
Okay.
And then in heart failure. But, the interesting thing is that, even though as in medicine, we specialize, but our patients are still, not coming in with just one issue. They come in with, all the things that, the body can carry. And, oftentimes pain is a very frequent companion.
Absolutely. And whether, I guess, in the hospital where I've been working, we have, in the cancer center, at least, we have obviously oncologists, we have psychiatrists, we have, a lot of different physicians who are on the care teams to support the patients, but we also, of course, have a palliative care team. And palliative care, we don't even call it palliative care at that hospital. We call it supportive care medicine, because palliative has kind of a connotation. I very recently had a guest on the show who's a pediatric palliative physician, and we talked a lot about what it means to palliate, what it means to treat pain, that pain management is something that happens at all course of illness. It's not something that only has to do with dying, even though a lot of people think that. Would you consider what you do to also be palliative care, even though you're not kind of technically a palliative care physician?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the definition of palliative care, or again, I think whenever you have to define something, what that automatically means is that its true meaning is not intuitive or isn't automatically obvious. But the way I think about palliative care is that it's a specialty that is focused on maximizing people's quality of life, and really provides multidimensional care that covers not just the sort of traditional biomedical focus, but really all the layers of experience that a person might feel. And certainly, I think that, and in fact, my research interest within cardiology is actually on palliative care. So the way I think about it is that most palliative care is actually provided by, or should be provided by, the non-palliative care specialist. So that would be your primary care physician, your cardiologist, your oncologist, etc. And then specialty palliative care, should be reserved for, more complicated matters. But really, the onus should be on the primary teams to do most of what, we traditionally place under palliative care's purview. So thinking about, for example, making sure people are not suffering, making sure people are not having uncontrolled symptoms, or making sure that the treatment that they get is the treatment that they want. Those are all things that are just good medicine. And yet, I think so many people, because now we have so many great palliative care physicians, many specialists will now, automatically just put that in palliative care's bin and make that their responsibility rather than really own those pieces as well. And certainly, I think pain control is one of those things that, you know, oftentimes I think gets, people will often refer to palliative care for that. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, most people who are in pain are not seeing palliative care physicians. They're not seeing pain specialists. They're seeing, you know, other physicians. Unless we start talking about pain, and unless all of us in medicine start to own pain, is not a condition that we refer someone for, but that we really own and take responsibility for, I think that's one thing that I really hope to be able to accomplish through the work that I'm doing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's kind of like there's a big difference between the sort of should that you describe and what's actually happening in practice. And that's not to say that there aren't incredibly compassionate, well-rounded, and really, really dedicated primary physicians and specialists out there who really do prioritize kind of patient-centered care, but also sadly, very often in specialties, you see, and I've seen it firsthand, individuals who are like, oh, but this is all I do, and that's up to these other specialists. And when that happens, so much falls through the cracks. And I see it as somebody who supports cancer patients from a psychotherapy perspective that, I mean, I remember once rounding with a palliative care specialist. And he was like, I need to do a suicide assessment on this patient. Obviously, this patient's not suicidal. They're thinking about end-of-life options. But their oncologist didn't understand that and, like, you know, flagged them for a suicidality assessment. And we were talking about kind of the role of palliative and psychology and psychiatry and all these different disciplines. And he was like, oh, I know a physician who, if a patient so much as cries in their office, they call for a psych consult. Mm. And I was like, no, no, no. And this is sadly the case in a lot of places, even in some of the best hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really one of the things, you know, in medicine, in so many ways, we have made so many advances and we've gotten better at so many things. But I think it's important to specialize in one way because you can develop a sort of core knowledge base. So, for example, my specialty is heart failure. And I, you know, on average will probably know more about my specialty than other cardiologists and certainly more than, you know, folks in other specialties. You know, having said that, you know, that doesn't mean that that is the only thing I should be able to take care of. You know, people who, for as an example, patients with heart failure on average have, you know, 5 or 6, sometimes more comorbidities or other conditions. So even though they're coming to our service with a potentially a primary diagnosis that's related to the heart, that doesn't mean that they don't have other issues that need to be taken care of. And oftentimes those issues can be the ones that are more important to the person coming in. So, you know, I had just had this very recent example where, you know, we had a patient who was very reluctant to be admitted to the hospital because he'd had some prior bad experiences, but he was coming in because his, you know, body was kind of overflowing with extra fluid, which is, you know, oftentimes a very primary symptom in folks who are having heart failure. But the thing that was bothering him the most was this pain that he was having in his leg from these ulcers that he had. And you know, before our team went to see him, I told everyone that we're not going to start talking to him about the heart or the heart failure, because as soon as we do that, he's going to feel like, well, this team is only, you know, focused on their own agenda, which is to treat the heart failure, but not what I care about, which is the pain. And so I think that that's one of the, and we see that in, you know, so many different ways where, you know, we're just trying to pass the buck and we're not really owning the whole patient. And I try to fight that both through my clinical work, but also through my writing and research, because we really just have to own the entire patient and take as much responsibility for them as we can for all the things that they're experiencing, both sort of quote unquote somatic, but also psychosomatic and purely psychological. And unless we do that, I think that there's going to be a big rift between, I think, what patients want us to do and be and what we end up being to them.
I completely agree. And especially when you mentioned, when it comes to this crossover, which we're going to discuss between pain and suffering, between the kind of nociceptive, very core sort of physiologic, biologic components of pain, and of course, these deep psychologic, memory-based, trauma-based experiences of pain. I can't tell you how often I work with patients who are referred out to me because of their, you know, quote, overwhelming anxiety, or because of their extreme psychological response to whatever it is that they're dealing with, when I really dig deep and I'm like, no, you're having a very normal response to a super scary diagnosis.
Yep.
Like, of course you're anxious. You have cancer. Of course you're anxious. You're about to have a really, really big impactful surgery. Or of course you're scared. Chemotherapy makes you so sick and it hurts and it's scary every time you go in for an infusion, and really kind of working through what's a normal response to an abnormal situation, and how, I guess, can we not pathologize humanity?
Mm.
Which I think is a big problem. We pathologize. It's sort of like when we work within a medical establishment, everything becomes a medical problem. But that's not always the case, is it?
No, and I think that that's really, to me, one of the pieces of, I think, where medicine's headed, where it's really disappointing, is that, you know, we try to always constrain the patient to our tools, our rituals, our practices. And instead of going the other way around, where we should try and modulate our tools, our rituals, and our treatments to the patient, we are trying to do the opposite. I mean, in some ways, we've done this with pain, for example, where pain is not something that just popped up, 200 years ago, but has been with us, even in, really across all species. And for most of human history, has had these wide spiritual, existential, metaphysical, social, cultural, political dimensions. But because our tools are, good at addressing only sort of purely physical phenomena, we've tried to sort of narrow and pigeonhole pain into being sort of, a purely mechanical disturbance in the body. And I think that obviously, I think the most obvious adverse effect from this type of thinking is probably the opioid epidemic. But it's so much more than that, where I think we've tried to constrain and narrow people's experiences into something that just doesn't capture any of what might be affecting them. Taking pain, which is, and again, and having written the book about this, but I think even if you haven't, I think people realize that it has so many vast dimensions that are affected by context, attention, prior trauma, etc. By reducing that to a scale from 1 to 10. I think it just shows how narrow-minded our focus has been. And really part of why I wanted to write the book was to, and part of, some of my previous work has also been trying to reverse engineer some of what I think, some of the step backs that we have taken, and try to really make sure that medicine continues to adapt to the patient rather than try and force them to adapt to us.
Yeah, I think, and this is sort of my own perspective here, which is, many, many years of kind of philosophic inquiry, but also combined with my scientific work and working as sort of an advocate and activist within this sort of scientific skeptic community, is such that I, I am an evidence-based thinker. I really, really promote evidence-based policy, evidence-based decision-making. I really value the scientific method, but I also think it has its limits, right? I'm not a logical positivist. I don't believe that just because something is can be sufficiently shown to be effective in a randomized controlled trial, that that's the only thing that exists. But I'm also very wary of, you know, alternative approaches to medicine that have been thoroughly debunked or that have been shown to be ineffective. That said, I'm also something of a constructivist in that I truly believe that the reality of the patient is what is real to them. And so even if I don't agree with a certain approach that they're taking, I think it's my job to work with them to understand risks and benefits and to try to utilize their frame of reference when I treat them. So I'm an atheist, but that doesn't mean that when I treat somebody who's Christian, who is dying, who talks about heaven, that I don't talk about heaven with them, because that's important. That's an important aspect of their care. And I guess I bring this up to say that even if I'm highly skeptical of alternative approaches, and even though I see the damage that they can cause when people delay treatment or when they use ineffective or harmful treatments, just belittling that and not trying to understand it causes such a rift between patient and provider that it can actually be more damaging than the alternative treatments that they're seeking.
I'm totally with you. I mean, you can have an open mind, and you can still want scientific rigor. I mean, I don't think that those two things are mutually exclusive. And you know, I think I always go back to this. No matter what you are doing in medicine, it all starts with the relationship between the medical team and the patient. And the relationship is based on mutual trust, mutual accountability, and respect. And ensuring that, you know, that everyone's goals are the same, which is that we want the best outcome for the patient. And once you have that, then everything else follows. I mean, even something as simple as, you know, treating blood pressure, for example, or treating someone's cholesterol, you can't do that effectively until unless there is a trusting relationship. And this is, you know, even more true with things that are, you know, actively with I would say spaces that are even more difficult to treat and manage. And I think, you know, chronic pain, for example, is one of them where, you know, our tools are not perfect. And we are still trying to, you know, clean up much of the mess that we ourselves created. But then putting the burden of that on the patient seems to be what we've done. I mean, in the end, I think, we've come such a long way. I mean, when part of what's been great about, you know, being so deep in the history of medicine, for, you know, end of life care, heart disease, and now pain, is that I never lose sight of the fact that yes, we have come a long way. I mean, it wasn't too long ago when people were getting CPR or being connected to breathing machines, even when they didn't want to, even when they expressly said that I don't want this treatment, they would still be forced to undergo those measures. And on the other hand, we had patients who were being denied those treatments without their knowledge, simply based on, you know, people just reacting to their biases. So I think we've come a long way, but I do think that there are still many, many gaps. But many of those start with this poor communication and poor relationship building. And then once everything else falls apart, then people, in medicine, we just blame the patient. We call them difficult. We call them non-compliant or non-adherent, et cetera, et cetera. And yet don't realize how we might have contributed, to those behaviors.
I'm curious how much you sort of contribute, how much of the problem you think is truly about the managed care system itself and the difficulty. Because I hear this very often when I speak to my friends and colleagues and individuals at work who are physicians about patient-centered care and just like, you know, the act of listening and compassion and how important it is. And so often the response I get is, I don't have time for that. It's so frustrating, but I've got, you know, I've got 15 minutes with this patient, or we're rounding and I, you know, I've got 5 minutes to really try and understand what's going on. And, you know, they feel a really intense pressure because of the way that billing basically works in this country. How much of that is really the fault of the managed care system? And B, even within that constrained system, can't we still be doing more?
So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the system just, you know, these are things that the system doesn't care about. The system, in the end, cares about, you know, productivity, which is code for how many patients did you see, how many tests did you order, how many procedures did you order, without any relationship with whether those things were the right thing to do, whether that was right for the patient, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think the system is a huge contributor to, and that we've seen that in medicine, where it's just become so corporate and, you know, at the highest level, all these, you know, the people in the C-suite, they're not having the conversation we're having. And they're having a very different conversation. They have Excel sheets up in front of them, and things are either red or black. And that has nothing to do with what is right or wrong. And I think that that's why I always go, you know, I think even though we're talking, I care about things that are human, humanistic, that are subjective, that relate to people's lived experiences. But I know that what contributes to them, or what takes us closer or away from those things, are hard things like who gets paid for what, and how do we decide to what behaviors or practices we reward and which ones we don't. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, a lot of what I did for this research was that, you know, for this book on chronic pain, was I spoke to a lot of pain physicians and surgeons, but I also spoke to pain psychologists, and who are doing, you know, to me some of the most important work, and whose therapies have, you know, a stronger evidence base and fewer risks than any other sort of surgeries or procedures. But they're often the ones who have the least amount of support. They're often the ones who are, you know, the ones who are most frustrated and who are spending the most time for the least reward, because our health system will, you know, they'll pay for the fifth back surgery someone's getting, even if the last four have failed. But they won't pay for the therapy that a patient needs, or they won't pay for the exercise or physical therapy that a patient needs. They won't pay for any of the other treatments that are not reimbursed in the same way in our health system. So we do spend a lot of money. I mean, I think that the trouble in healthcare in this country is not that we're not spending money. Actually, the opposite. We're spending a lot of money, but how we choose to spend it and where you spend it has, you know, can oftentimes be odd with what we know works and what we know doesn't.
Absolutely. And here's another quick example as an aside, and then and then dive right, but like put a pin in that. Hospice care, something that I'm super passionate about. Mm-hmm. I can't work in hospice as a licensed psychologist. Once I get my license, I can't get reimbursed. Like, there's no room for me. They'll pay a social worker, but they won't pay me. So if I want to do end-of-life care, I'm going to have to be creative, and I'm going to have to do it from, sadly, outside of the hospice system, because otherwise I can't get paid. Like, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about when the crisis in American healthcare, I mean, we spend a disproportionate amount of money on people right in their last year of life. And yet all that money is being spent on things that clearly didn't help someone live longer. When it comes to the hospice system, yes, you know, hospice still gets paid on a kind of on a per diem on a daily basis, and that base rate is just not enough to support a lot of the services that the patients who are really have a very limited prognosis and who are extremely sick. You know, many times hospice just doesn't cover the needs that the patient has, and yet we have this expectation that hospice has to prove that they're cost effective. Yet we don't ask the same of all the care that people are receiving in the hospital. There's a huge discordance between what we know patients want, what we know works for patients, and then what we choose to actually pay for. And I think that's really one of the huge factors at the heart of the fact that despite spending so much money, there is so much suffering and unnecessary suffering in our society.
And some of those decisions that that actively contribute to suffering, not some, very many, almost have nothing to do with the actual healthcare itself and have everything to do with how it is provided. And one of the examples that I can't help but bring up, and I'm curious about your take on this, because when I've seen what I might refer to as bad deaths in the hospital or bad deaths even out of the hospital with some of the patients that I've worked with, one of the easiest things that we could have avoided, but one of the things that caused, I think, a significant amount of suffering was a lack of continuity of care, was just having too many different providers, new providers, people who don't know what this person needs. I mean, I remember working with a patient the day before she died in the hospital, and her nurses and physicians were calling her by the wrong name because they didn't know her. And on her file, it said her name and the name she likes to go by, and nobody even bothered to look at it. Can you imagine the indignity of being called the wrong name the day before you die? Something as simple as pretending that you know me in a scary place where your life is ending. I mean, I feel like it doesn't take that much training, to learn how to be a human being. Yet it's sort of the last thing on the list of how we train providers.
Yes. Nowadays, we're still in August, and as many viewers may know, every July we have a new set of physicians who just graduated medical school and they start their residency. So they essentially become in whatever specialty that they've chosen. So I've been working pretty extensively throughout July with just brand new interns, and I'm not spending a lot of time teaching them medicine or drug side. I mean, we're doing all of those technical things, but so much of what I'm trying to do and what I spend my time doing is teaching them about communication. And a lot of it isn't, I think that this idea that, it's all about time. I actually don't think it's about just time. I mean, it is how you spend that time, how you look at the person in front of you, and how do you understand what they want to hear. And how they are reacting to the information you're giving them. Are you giving it in a way that they understand? Are you giving it in a way that they feel engaged? Are you creating space for doubts or questions to come up? Are you bringing in other resources that can help you inform, educate, and engage a patient? Those are the things that I find that I was spending a lot of time just trying to sort of cover, make up for that. But I know that other physicians, they're not doing that either. Because again, I think that we all sort of gravitate towards different things naturally. But I do think that is such an important part about. It makes everything else we do that much more effective.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's like it's if you can communicate effectively, you don't have to do the same thing 10 times. And I see this so often where I'll be speaking with a provider. I was in therapy and my patient mentioned blah, 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 blah. And they asked if I follow up with you because they're still really confused about their prognosis, for example. And they're like, well, I've told her 10 times. I don't understand what she's confused about. It's like, well, you may have told her, but she clearly did not hear you. So, and that's really the, like, why is it that we're not taught to say at the end or at periodic points during the encounter? So what is it that you, you took away from what we just said? Can you repeat back to me what you, what was meaningful to you from this interaction? Did I answer your questions, you know, sufficiently?
And it'll make everything, and which is, yeah, so going back, and it just makes, yeah, treating blood pressure is not just about picking the right medication.
Right.
It is about explaining, A, what blood pressure is, what can blood pressure do to the body, explaining to someone what are the things that might contribute to that, telling them that they have agency and control over this outcome, that it is not just a fait accompli. And then explaining to them, oh, these are the different options we have. These are the trade-offs, but that this is the expected sort of upside. And I think unless you've done that and you're and a patient comes in, they don't take your medication, unless you've gone through all those steps, you have no right to blame the patient if they didn't take their medication.
Agree. And I would say, I would even go further as to say, and to do all of that without guilt or shaming the patient, because so often, I love the way that you just phrased that, that sort of they have agency and there are a lot of decisions that they can make to help empower them to really take control of their health is very different than, well, if you just exercise more, and basically guilting and shaming them into feeling like they can no longer open up to you because they're only going to be met with judgment.
Right. And I think creating a safe space for that is it's just so critical. Especially for things that are hard, especially for, you know, the hardest things that we deal with as in, you know, in medicine. I think, you know, heart failure is really hard. Chronic pain is really hard. And that's why I've always gravitated towards these tougher conditions, is because I'd like to think that, you know, I can make more of a difference in those spaces.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about pain, because I think obviously this is a really multidimensional issue. We're clearly not going to be able to cover everything I want to cover in the time that we have allotted. But there are a couple things that come up for me just sort of at the top of my head that I would love to dive into. I'll sort of rattle them off at the top, and you know, obviously we can come back to them as we do. Number one, I'm super interested to talk a little bit about the opioid epidemic and some of the failures, but also sadly how it has now led to the way that we treat the sickest of our patients. And I have some specific examples or questions that I have for you about, you know, patients who basically are dealing with end of life, very painful cancers, who are denied treatment because of risk or fear of addiction, which is frustrating to me, to say the least. On top of that, though, I would also like to talk, when it comes to pain, about, you know, really like what pain is, how we define it, how we treat it, and some of the historical wrongdoing. And actually, I don't want to say historical because this shit still happens all the time. But basically, some of the especially gender and ethnic inequities that we see in how we treat patients with pain, like women not being listened to, people of color, let's say somebody with a sickle cell crisis, for example, not being taken seriously. So I don't know, wherever you want to start, whatever kind of comes up for you, let's just dive in.
I think that what's clear is that this notion that pain is a purely physical sensation, i.e. that it is almost the same as your heart rate or your blood pressure, is a very modern sort of construct. And, you know, part of it, this originated because of, I think, you know, good reasons that I think that people wanted to make sure that we were putting pain at the center of how we think about patients rather than just a sort of, you know, bystander. But a lot of it was just motivated by the fact that, well, we had a lot of, tools that could work on, let's say, acute pain very well, such as, you know, opioids are a great example of. There are great medications for if you have acute pain. Let's say if you broke your you know, arm, or if you have acute appendicitis, et cetera. I mean, opioids are about, you know, as good as it gets to provide relief in that setting. But there was a big push towards really trying to expand that to all patients, not just people with acute injuries, not just people who are at the end of life, but really everyone with back pain, everyone with a headache, everyone with neck pain. I mean, that's billions of people. But without any data, without any sort of real data showing, you know, well, we know that these therapies work in the acute setting. We have no idea if they work for chronic pain. Now we know, at least in the randomized trials for musculoskeletal pain, that people who take opioids actually have more pain than people right. who don't.
Not only do they not work, but they also induce all sorts of negative psychological consequences.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think people don't realize is that, you know, we, all of us in the human body has this rich sort of inner machinery that's all dependent on these opioids that we make ourselves, these endogenous opioids. And these endogenous opioids are always being made in our body to do many different things. One is that they ensure that, you know, everyday nicks and nacks don't cause us a lot of pain, that, you know, if you're sitting in a weird angle for a long time, that, you know, you don't develop, you know, debilitating discomfort. But beyond that, they're these chemicals that allow us to feel satisfied, to feel you know, happy, to feel, you know, content, to feel love and social connection. And once you blast the system with a pill that is so potent that it completely takes away your body's ability to experience those same things without another pill, I think you've really set up a crisis in which not only is someone dependent on them for, you know, pain relief, but also just for just to be emotionally, you know, in an emotional homeostasis or balance, so to speak. But really, I think what the science of pain suggests is that it is not just a physical sensation, but it is really as much an emotion and as much a traumatic memory as it is a physical sensation. And I think unless we accept the complexity of pain and not try and sort of constrain it to our very primitive tools, I think only then do we open the door for treatments that can actually help people in the real world, where things like pain and things like suffering often overlap and are often made worse by, you know, prior history of trauma or prior history of discrimination or abuse.
It's just so fundamental. Like, if we're not taking the time to understand somebody who has, let's say, chronic back pain because of an injury at work, for example, to really understand their employment history, their life satisfaction, their quality of life, how are they in their relationship? Do they have sufficient social support? Are they economically comfortable? If we don't understand all of these different aspects of them, we don't truly understand how their pain affects them. We can't.
I couldn't agree more. And if you think about what are the factors, you know, many listeners or many folks have had, you know, acute pain. Let's say you bump into a glass door, but not all acute pain turns into chronic pain. The question is, well, why does some pain, or why does pain in some turn into chronic pain when it doesn't for others? And oftentimes, I think we try and we want there to be a you know, almost a biological or biomechanical reason for that. So, you know, when I had my, you know, back injury in medical school, which, you know, just basically, you know, essentially put my life on hold for, you know, for many years. I thought that my pain could be explained by my MRI and what I saw in the MRI, which was all these abnormalities, like I had this prolapsed disc, I had all these degenerative changes, et cetera, et cetera. And yet the truth is that that those MRI findings actually have no correlation with chronic pain. They have no correlation with predicting if someone's acute pain is going to turn chronic. There's many studies showing that even amongst young, healthy people were totally asymptomatic, you just take them off the street and put them in an MRI scanner, that you're going to find a lot of these really nasty sounding abnormalities. And what the research actually said, and so that was, you know, eye-opening for me, because that was my origin story, right? That was what I had always told myself, and that's what would always give me comfort, that, oh, if anyone doubts me or that doubts that I'm suffering, I can always tell them, oh, you know what, I had this MRI and it showed all these things and that's why I'm in pain. But yet, the truth of the matter is that it was probably why I had that acute episode, but it had no correlation with the fact that I ended up developing chronic pain. And if you think about the most common factors why acute pain turns into chronic, most often it has nothing to do with the anatomy. It has everything to do with everything else. So just as something like having an adverse childhood experience. So is one of the most strongest risk factors for the development of chronic pain. If you think about and other things that, you know, just being extremely anxious or having a history of trauma or having a history of abuse. I mean, those are all some of the most strongest associations with that can predict the development of chronic pain. And I think what that tells you is that, you know, pain is not just an experience that you feel in a part of your body. And this idea that pain is a quote unquote musculoskeletal issue, I think, again, narrows our focus, which is why I think a multidisciplinary approach to pain is really what we need. Is that, you know, if someone, especially for folks with chronic pain, it is not enough for them to see a surgeon. It is not enough for them to see a physician who's going to prescribe them medication, but they also have to see someone like you, someone who will go beyond just the sort of basic sort of mechanics, but really explore the context of that pain. They need to see an exercise physiologist who's going to work with them and who's going to help them overcome the fear that pain induces in just moving our body.
Right, which then sadly exacerbates the pain.
Totally. It just traps you in this vortex. And so that's really, and so it's funny, we started off with this idea that medicine has become very specialized. And really, I think that's one of the reasons why something like pain, which is complex and which, you know, doesn't live in any one specialty. You know, every specialty in medicine deals with pain in their own way. You know, if you're in a gynecologist, you might be seeing patients with, you know, endometriosis, etc. If you're a surgeon, you're seeing people with back pain. If you're a cardiologist, you may see, you know, we see patients who have, you know, chronic chest pain that, you know, we never find an obvious sort of abnormality for, and we think that, oh, just because we didn't see something on a scan, oh, that's fine, then we don't have to worry. And in fact, something like that can, you know, can cause even more distress in a patient, because now they're made to feel like, oh, they're somehow to blame for feeling that way.
Oh, which is so common. It's so interesting. Like, two things, I'm going to get a little personal for a second, take mm-hmm. a little aside and get a little personal, but two mm-hmm. things come up for me that, I'm excited that I'm talking to a cardiologist here, but B, the other one is more gynecologic. So for my listeners who have been following my journey over the past couple of months, they know that I recently had a surgery. My first I had two surgeries in a row. One was for the actual pathology, and then the next one was the actual treatment, because I was diagnosed with AIS, adenocarcinoma in situ, so like very early stage cervical cancer. And so I had to have a total hysterectomy at the age of 38. Really scary, really hard. And I, talked to my doctor about pain management, was ready for the opiates, was ready for Dilaudid in my IV, was ready for hydrocodone at home. And ultimately, I didn't take any opiates. In the hospital, I woke up, they asked me about my pain. I was like, I don't think it's that bad. So they're like, we're going to stick with Toradol until, you know, we decide otherwise. And then at home, I just did an ibuprofen regimen. And this is acute pain. And it hurt, but I was okay. And I was lucky, I have to say, that I had spoken to so many people in advance about the first poop after surgery. And that I had really thought a lot about what it means to poop and how painful and scary it can be after you've been on opiates, after you've had anesthesia, all of the different contributing factors. And for me, my pain management worked for me. It was like I was kept under a threshold I was comfortable when I wasn't moving. When I was moving, I knew how to move my body to avoid any acute kind of crises. But then when it was finally time for me to have that first poop, I didn't think I was dying, which was very important to me because that part of the pain was, there was trauma around that. Like I did not want to experience that kind of post-surgery trauma. And it's funny because I talk to other women in the same position and they're like, oh my God, I was on opiates for like a week or I was on opiates for this minute. And I'm like, it's so interesting that clearly it's not just biological because if it were, we would probably all need the same regimen.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly I was in a position where I was highly supported, where I had a lot of love and I had a lot of things that I needed to feel comfortable. Although I was experiencing a huge loss, I never wanted children. So it didn't have this added component loss to it. And like, I think because of all of those psychological components, all of those supportive components, my pain was different, even in an acute setting, not even in a chronic setting. So I think even these principles that we think of as applying to long-term pain, it'd be cool to start looking at the research of how they apply to acute pain as well.
I mean, I think that... And this is not to say, and just to be clear to everyone, is that, well, if you are having pain, then, you know, because let's say you're not in a supportive environment and you've had prior bad experiences or you felt unheard in a healthcare setting, and if those are the factors that are making you experience more pain, that somehow dismisses or delegitimizes what you feel. If anything, I think it represents a sort of even greater failure on our part in healthcare. But yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's so much work that's been done in this space. I'm someone in many ways like yourself that I find so much of science interesting, so much of medicine interesting, and so I feel like I've understand a lot of what we do, and of all the fields that I've really dived deep into, the gulf between the science and the practice of pain is probably the widest that I've seen. In fact, you know, one of the researchers who is you know, one of the single most prominent and interesting and well-funded researchers, who's a neuroscientist, he's been banned by the pain department in the hospital to teach their fellows because apparently he was told that his research actually shows that everything that they're learning is incorrect.
Oh no. And, oh my gosh. And of course the reaction is not let's iterate. It's let's just not rock the boat. How
horrible. Let's just pretend like that doesn't exist. And I love this quote about describing his work, which basically says that, you know, his research funding is more than the GDP of many countries, and it's true, and he's totally worth it because and some of what his work shows is that when acute pain turns into chronic pain, the signature of pain in the brain actually changes, where acute pain occupies parts of the brain that are much more related to physical sensations. As it becomes more chronic, it occupies parts of the brain that are more related with emotions and memory and trauma.
And
I think that's one of the reasons why, and I think one of the reasons we fail so many patients is that I think the very definition of chronic pain is flawed, because if you look at the definition of chronic pain, the assumption is that the only difference between acute and chronic pain is that, oh, chronic pain just lasts for a longer period of time.
Right, it's acute pain that just didn't go away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if you look at the fact that most treatments for acute pain actually don't do much for chronic pain, but also that the actual biology of chronic pain and the neural signature of chronic pain is just very, very different from that of chronic pain, from acute pain. I think that is really one of the big takeaways that I, you know, would love readers to sort of carry. We're really dealing with very different phenomena. And again, I think when we let clinical medicine kind of roll along without being rooted in the sort of evidence base you need, you end up with in a really bad place. I mean, if you think about the opioid epidemic, you know, again, it's evolved now, but it is the single greatest medically induced tragedy in the history of the entire world. And
so many lives lost, like needlessly, completely needlessly.
But also think about what we've done. And like you said, you started by saying this, that now if you're someone who's been prescribed opioids, I mean, you get treated like a drug addict in the hospital.
Oh, I literally have a friend who has GBM, like glioblastoma multiforme. Like they are going to die from this disease. And it's not going to take that long at this point. And they have had palliative physicians tell them, you're in a stage where you don't need fentanyl. You're in a stage where you don't need whatever. You know, based on your scans, I don't believe that you need the kind of pain management that you're looking for. And it's like, my answer to that is, A, who are they to say that? This is a patient who is clearly in pain and who is dying from this disease. These are the patients for whom these opiates were literally developed. But then B, even if they were drug seeking, why would you care at this point? Like, that's the other thing that frustrates me. It's like we treat end of life patients as if we're trying to extend their life and as if they're in a different phase completely. Like, even if they are trying to palliate something beyond pain, something psychological, something deep because they're suffering, because their life is being taken from them by this horrid disease, who are we as the providers to be able to dangle that carrot and say, oh no, you don't qualify, you don't deserve this? It's heartbreaking.
And that's it's, and I think that the lack of introspection in medicine about what we've done to patients, both first by exposing them to treatments that, you know, we told them, and even the FDA said, were not addictive when you know, right. This is one of the most addictive substances in the history of humankind. You know, opium has been around for 5,000 years. So this is, you know, we shouldn't have, you know, why were we claiming, or why was the FDA claiming, that this is not going to be addictive, but then
right
B,
because of that industry, because of that industry regulation partnership, yeah, right there, right?
Of course, but now that then after exposing so many, now we're saying, okay, this is, you know, we just, you know, pin it all on the evil big pharma and don't take any responsibility for the fact that, you know, none of the Sacklers wrote a single prescription for any of these medications. We physicians did. And then if any of us has a responsibility, it's us. And I think that, and we've already seen a world where opioids are never used. And that was really in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, back in, at the end of the, you know, after the Civil War, that's when the first big opioid epidemic actually hit the U.S. This was a time 1 in 200 Americans was taking opioids, and not just in, you know, people who are, you know, who are affected by the war, but really in society. This, you know, morphine had been discovered. I mean, high society women would carry, you know, hypodermic needles and necklaces, and this led to then what happened was we had, you know, Chinese immigrants who were smoking opium. And so even so, before that, no one really cared. But now that all these, you know, immigrants are smoking opium, now we decided to crack down on it. This led to, you know, a complete shutdown of all opioid use in the U.S. was followed by the war on drugs. And what that led to was, in fact, this uncontrolled people in uncontrolled pain and distress at the end of life, which inspired Cecily Saunders to start the hospice movement in the UK, and then it came. So we know what that world looks like where no one gets opium, and it's not great, it's not pretty, and none of us would want to go back there. And so really, we just need to have a harder conversation about how can we use these drugs more responsibly? How can we get more evidence about other therapies that that are less harmful? How can we develop, if our goal is to get folks, for example, off of these drugs, how do we do it well? How do we do it in a way that we don't leave people suffering? How do we give them other options or alternatives if we're going to take this stuff away from them? So, and, you know, I think that there's some people who are having these conversations, but I think for the most part, And I think that's part of what I would love to have this book do, is to really make sure that we just don't forget about this. There's so much going on that's competing for people's attention. And I think especially when you've had there's something in your past and your history that is shameful, which I think we should all, and medicine, we should all be ashamed about how we let this happen. There's this tendency to just gloss over it and just move on. And I want to, you know, pump the brakes on this and make sure that we learn the mistakes that we did and make sure that we do right by people in pain and ensure that we don't do the same thing again and that we provide care for the entire person rather than just for the part that we can, that our tools are designed for.
Absolutely. You know, and it's, I'm loving the crossover between, I've had a lot of different guests on the show who, more and more sort of advocating in this way. I shouldn't say a lot. Maybe they just stand out to me. It's actually probably a very small number. But somebody who comes up for me that I just want to remind listeners of was a previous episode I had with Talia Marone Schatz. And if you guys remember, she is a psychologist, basically a social psychologist, or sometimes they call her behavioral economist, who studied under I think Dan Kahneman, and she wrote a book called Your Life Depends on It, What You Can Do to Make Better Choices About Your Health. And it's really all about medical decision-making. It's all about self-advocacy. And it's a very humanistic approach to kind of managing and navigating our healthcare system and kind of demanding that your needs be met. And I think it's such an important, it's so sad that we have to say, all right, patients, like the onus is on you, but it really has to be, it has to be a two-pronged system, right? We need to work to overhaul the medical system and continue to push for more humanistic patient-centered care. But we also, as patients, need to realize that that may be my only cardiologist. I am probably one of, you know, 500 of that cardiologist's patients. And even though that cardiologist might care so much about me, something is going to slip through the cracks if I don't care about it. I have to advocate for myself. It's the only way.
I think that's just the truth. I mean, there's so many times I'm speaking to a patient, and oftentimes there'll be a daughter or, you know, a wife or, you know, another sort of woman in their life who is going to be their strongest advocate. And at the end, they'll apologize. And I'll say, well, why are you apologizing? Because if you won't advocate for your loved one, chances are that, you know, bad things could happen. And that's just the reality.
Nobody else will. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just a reality. I mean, if you're lucky, that you might find, you might not have to, but we can't assume that.
And especially if you're a woman, especially if you're a woman of color or a gender minority or an individual with a language barrier, an individual with, as we mentioned before, some psychological or social or just situational reasons that make your interactions with healthcare fraught. You're going to fall through. The system isn't designed for people to fall through the cracks. It's like literally not designed to catch people under the cracks. It's designed that if somebody doesn't call 10 times and make sure that the thing's on the books and make sure the answer or the question is answered, that there won't be a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just doesn't work that way. You know, nobody's coming out and looking out for you. You have to look out for yourself. And sadly, if you can't, we need to be building better social systems that allow us to. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but I'm glad it's one that we agree on. You know, it's funny, and we're really running low on time, but one of the things that I was going to mention earlier, and this is sort of going to feel plugged in now, but you were talking about how based on your scans, you would think that your pain would be a very particular way. And so often there is a massive disconnect between sort of the evidence base and the, I guess, subjective perception of pain. It reminds me of, two things come up for me. It reminds me of basically studies about placebo. And, you know, one thing I'm always trying to sort of like pound into people's heads is that like placebo is not medicine. Placebo is the lack of medicine. Placebo is actually the thing that we use in randomized controlled trials to say there was no therapeutic given. And so when people talk about a placebo effect, they're not actually talking about the placebo doing anything. They're talking about non-specific effects like interacting with a doctor or being hopeful or, you know, having a regular schedule because you're part of the study, and all those things can have positive impacts. But the funny thing is, when it comes to treatment, we see over and over and over again that the, quote, placebo effect is strongest with things that have subjective outcomes like pain. And it's the weakest with things that have objective outcomes like mortality. Like, there is no placebo effect when it comes to how long you're going to live. But there is definitely a placebo effect when it comes to pain. So that's, to me, super fascinating.
And I think that what that is, that and that, when I speak, especially when I speak to physicians, I tell them that that is a superpower that we all have, is in fact our ability to provide the placebo effect, and that we should think about how can we make ourselves even more placebogenic.
Right. Like, how can you even make the treatment have a placebo effect? Like, everything be stronger because everything, of that.
Because everything, every treatment, even things like very strong painkillers like opioids. I mean, if you know, in experiments when people were told that who were getting IV fentanyl infusions, that their infusions had stopped when in fact they hadn't, the entire effect of the drug went away.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. That's fascinating, but it does not surprise me. Oh,
And so instead of thinking, at least in clinical care, I know in research it can be a pain for when people are trying to make new drugs, but at least in clinical care, we should be thinking about how can we make ourselves the most placebogenic physicians or clinicians or nurses in the world? And the way to do that is by being kind, being empathetic, by listening, by encouraging, by doing all these simple things that we just call, you know, being a good human being, letting people be seen, letting people feel like they're being attended to and cared for. Because that is something that, you know, you don't have to do a procedure for. You don't have to go to, you know, that is something that all of us can carry and all of us can deploy.
Yeah, you don't have to have a medical degree to do this, right? Like, you can learn this without ever having gone to college. You can learn this at a very base. Children learn this. We can do it too. It's so funny. And so the other thing that I just wanted to throw in really quick, it's a quick little like anecdote, and it could open up a whole can of worms, but we don't need to go there, is that when you were talking about, you know, looking at your scans and how there's this disconnect between what your scans look like and what the experience is. I had a similar experience recently where my heart was beating too fast all the time. Like, I was really tachycardic in my surgery, and I was noticing that my heart, my Garmin, like, you know, like my Fitbit, whatever, was going off all the time. Abnormal heart rate, abnormal heart rate, abnormal heart rate. And I went to my physician recommended I see a cardiologist. I wore a Holter monitor for a week. I didn't have any symptoms. I didn't have palpitations. It just constantly was going off. And then I went and saw the cardiologist. She was like, okay, first we look at rhythm. Then we look at your, you know, so we do the EKG and the Holter monitor. Then we look at structure. We do the full echocardiogram, or not echocardiogram. What's it called? The
MRI.
Yeah, but Holter, like the sonogram, basically, of your heart. And she was like, you know, we're looking for this. We're looking for that. And at the end, she was like, your heart's beautiful. It functions perfectly. It's just really fast. We don't know why. It's, you know, inappropriate sinus tachycardia. It's fine. Your blood pressure's low. They balance each other out. You know, whatever the explanation was, but she was like, here is my recommendation. Like, she almost wrote it on her prescription pad. Stop wearing a Fitbit. And she was like, we are living in a world of big data. And now people are getting evidence of how abnormal normal really is. Like, we had standards of normality based on very tightly controlled studies. And now that we're democratizing healthcare, and now that people can peer inside their bodies easier and easier, we're seeing that normal is a range. You have a fast, healthy heart, and that's okay. That's okay. And so don't wear the thing that constantly alerts you that your heart's too fast, because it's not too fast. And all that's going to do is give you anxiety. And I was like, I love this perspective. It's such a beautiful perspective. And it was so, I don't know, just freeing to me to hear that. Like, she was a great cardiologist. I'm not sure how often people have that, but that's just a random anecdote that I thought you might enjoy as a cardiologist.
Oh, that was great. she was at her placebogenic best.
Yes, she was. So anyway, okay, so there's so much more we could talk about. Obviously, we don't have that, like, really any more time. But I do close my episodes with the same two questions. I would love to close out with you by asking you the same two questions. Before we do it, is there anything that we didn't cover, anything we didn't get into that you kind of just want to hammer in?
No, I think we covered a lot of space.
Awesome.
And yep.
Good, good, good. All right. So listen, I'm super curious about your perspective. I always close my show by asking my guests two questions. They're big picture questions, and they really have to do with thinking about the future. So the first one is that when you think about the future, this could be in whatever context is relevant to you. Clearly, it could be your work, but it could be personal. It could be communal, global, cosmic, whatever. First, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing you really are, you know, worried about, concerned about? Maybe you're bordering on pessimism, even cynicism. But then on the flip side of that, ending on a more positive note, where do you find your optimism lately? You know, the authentic, not the Pollyanna, but the authentic, true hopefulness. What are you looking forward to?
What worries me a lot is that how partisanship in this country has had so much spillover into health behaviors, into views about science, into really how we adjudicate reality. And we've done some, you know, research in this space as well, showing just what the mortality cost is of hyper-partisanship in this country. And I think that really worries me and where that's headed. I think what I'm optimistic about is, I mentioned earlier that, you know, it's the start of the academic year, and it's really just young people who are coming in to medicine, and they're just so much more open, and they're just so much more interested you know, really, it's thinking about how we can do better for patients, and who are just really excited about wanting to do the best that they can for people, and learning about new things. I think that's, you know, one of the, you know, everyone talks about, you know, we talk about burnout, but I think that really is the antidote to burnout, at least for me, is just surrounding yourself with, you know, awesome young people who give me a lot of hope. So yes, I think that is to me the most exciting part.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. And you're right. That is an antidote to burnout. It's funny. I remember looking at a study, actually, that one of my supervisors co-authored about individuals working in end-of-life care and that ritual around death, right? So when you lose a patient, instead of just kind of moving on, but really engaging in some sort of personal ritual, whatever is meaningful to you, whether it be a prayer, whether it be like for me, I stamp their initials into a little token and I put them in a jar. Like, it's a very aggressive way, because it's like a jewelry stamping kit. But then I have their memory. It's in a jar. I collect them, and it's a ritual that I do, and I think about them while we're doing it. But that in itself is an antidote for burnout for people who work in those fields. It's like taking time. It's the humanism of it all. Yeah.
No, that's beautiful.
It's so fundamental. Well, gosh, Heather, I've learned so much from you. There's so much more to learn. I really hope everybody picks up this book, The Song of Our Scars, The Untold Story of Pain, because we will all experience pain. We will all suffer. It is a fundamental part of life. And learning how to understand ourselves, learning how to advocate for ourselves, learning how to cope, and how to, I think, even maybe more importantly, learn from those experiences and have that post-traumatic growth as opposed to the post-traumatic stress. It's what it means to be human. And so it's such an important topic. And I'm so grateful, A, for the public science communication and medical communication that you're doing to help inform people, but B, for the incredible work that you do in your own practice and in teaching the future generation of physicians, because it's just, we need more like you. And so I appreciate that as well.
No, thank you so much for speaking. I had so much and so much fun. Looking forward to more in the future.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy. All right. So I'm going to stop this recording. But what happened last time is she couldn't hear me after I stopped the recording, which was weird. So I'm going to see if that happens again. If you can't hear me, I'll chat you something. But I've just got to download the file super quick. So okay. I can't do it until I stop. Hitting the button now.